Reflecting on remarks made by keynote speaker and Vietnamese President Tô Lâm, he called on countries to build a strategic framework to foster trust and avoid confrontation. I'll bring you the details.
Meantime, the U.S. says President Trump will only make a deal with Iran if it meets all his conditions, days after both sides reached a potential agreement to end the war. And the first of five men trapped in a flooded cave in Laos goes free. Rescuers say they'll resume the effort to pull out the rest today, and two others remain missing. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is set to speak later this hour at the Shangri-La Dialogue here in Singapore. The Pentagon has said he'll focus on the Trump administration's, quote, common sense approach to safeguarding U.S. vital interests in the Indo-Pacific. The address is expected to be closely watched for signals of America's long-term commitment to the region, even as Washington remains occupied by conflicts in the Middle East and Europe. U.S. officials have indicated that he will urge allies and partners to boost defense spending and strengthen their own military capabilities. His remarks follow President Donald Trump's summit earlier this month with Chinese President Xi Jinping, which was aimed at stabilizing relations between the superpowers. The annual security summit opened last night with a keynote address by Vietnam's President Tô Lâm. He warned the world is facing multiple security risks, with smaller nations coming under increasing pressure to choose sides. And CNA's Arnold Gay joins us live from Shangri-La, Singapore. Arnold, you've been covering Shangri-La for the past few days. What stood out most to you from Mr. Lam's address yesterday?
Hi there, Grace. So he spoke for about 20 minutes, and one word kept coming up, and that's trust, a significant, you know, statement at a defense summit happening amid two major wars and rising tensions here in the Indo-Pacific. Mr. Lam's message was clear. He wants to promote dialogue. He wants to promote trust and cooperation, but he did not say don't compete. What he's saying is don't let competition turn into confrontation. Well, CNA senior correspondent Leong Wai Kit was in the room listening closely. Here's his take.
Shangri-La Dialogue organizers have described Vietnam leader Tô Lâm's keynote speech that took place at the ballroom behind me as historic. It's the first time a Vietnamese leader who's both the president and head of the country's Communist Party has made a speech on the security forum. One key word that recurred in Mr. Lâm's translated address was rules. Mr. Lâm stressed the importance of a rules-based order as a foundation for all countries. And as part of Mr. Lâm's proposals to promote peace in the region, to make rules and dialogue truly effective tools to reduce risks. Mr. Lâm added the Shangri-La Dialogue should remain a platform where nations listen carefully to one another, seek clarifications, and find common grounds. He also warned against using the SLD as a channel to merely state or restate one's position. Mr. Lâm also highlighted that instability today doesn't arise solely from military conflict, but also from fractures in development itself.
Defense preparedness is legitimate, but sustainable security cannot rest on military power alone. Still less can it be built through arms races or by increasing developmental insecurity for others. What we need instead is a development foundation capable of withstanding systemic shocks.
Mr. Lâm noted in his speech that competition is a reality, but it has to be bounded by law. He also warned that a difference of interest could escalate into confrontation.
Strategic trust does not require elimination of differences or denying competition. Its essence lies in managing differences within a rules-based framework, ensuring that competition remains bounded, responsible, and predictable. A durable regional order cannot be built upon perpetual fear and mutual distrust.
Mr. Lâm also shared the importance of increasing preventive diplomacy to manage differences. One analyst described how Vietnam had used that strategy with the Thai-Cambodia conflict and how Mr. Lâm asserted ASEAN centrality.
With Cambodia, Vietnam consistently tells the Cambodian government not to use force and to adhere to ASEAN centrality. And when it comes to Thailand, President Tô Lâm just went to Thailand, and in that During that visit, then President Tolum explicitly told the Thai government that Vietnam also want Thailand to adhere to ASEAN centrally, and Vietnam doesn't support any kind of conflict between ASEAN's members. And throughout the entire region as a whole, then President Tolum is trying to show that Vietnam is ready to become a mediator, and also trying to make sure that its peers' members' interests are honored.
Vietnam also used the keynote speech to emphasize Hanoi's position on disputed waters. Mr. Lum said Vietnam's position on the East Sea remains clear, including supporting peaceful settlement of all disputes based on international law. He also described Vietnam and China's inaugural 3+3 talks, focusing on security, defense and diplomacy as a mechanism that can boost cooperation. This was in response to a Chinese delegation's question on whether those talks would be a new approach moving forward. The Shangri-La dialogue coincides with Mr. Lum's Southeast Asia visit. He had just wrapped up a trip to Thailand before Singapore and will be heading for the Philippines next. Leong Wai-kit, CNA.
So Grace, that sets the tone for the three-day summit. The focus will be on defense and deterrence, with peace as the ultimate objective.
Peace is the ultimate objective here, and eyes are closely watching U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's speech, which is scheduled next. What do you expect Mr. Hegseth to talk about when he gets on that stage in less than half an hour from now?
Well, Grace, under that umbrella of a common sense approach you were just talking about, we are looking at several underlying layers as well. The concept that was mooted last year was peace through strength. We've seen examples of this in the past year as well. The whole notion of burden sharing through increased defense spending is going to be something that all participants will be listening closely out for as well. U.S. commitment to the Indo-Pacific, another important point here. I mean, it's closely related, of course, to the posture of U.S. forces in the region, whether or not the U.S. Is stretched because of what's happening mainly in the Middle East, as well as in the central and southern parts of the American continent. And of course, it will be interesting to see what he says, what his tone will be on China. And we will be looking at all of these very closely once he gives his address and after he gives his address as well. Meantime, back to you, Grace.
Definitely many variables to consider there. Thank you so much in the meantime. That was CNA's Arnold Gay reporting live from Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. And here on CNA, we'll be bringing you Mr. Hegseth's address at the event live in just a few minutes. We'll also have some expert analysis after the speech. Jonathan Cavalry, senior fellow at the IISS, will join us in the next hour. So do keep watching us. On the sidelines of the summit, the International Committee of the Red Cross has renewed calls for political negotiations to prevent a worsening humanitarian crisis linked to the war on Iran. The organization's president spoke to CNA, saying there's no alternative to de-escalation.
What I saw in Iran is a huge country, a very large population, a resourceful population, and a country that has the potential to escalate for a long time to come. The longer this situation continues, and if there is a renewed escalation from a humanitarian perspective, not only from an economic one, but from a humane perspective, the consequences will be disastrous and they would get easily out of control. It's irrelevant because a human life is a human life. A child on this side or on this side of the line deserves equal protection. We start not before the war in terms of we work with those who haven't started the war. We work with everyone to protect civilians because civilians per se are not combatants and they have to be spared from the hostilities no matter where they sit.
It's time for a short break, but ahead on Asia Now. The U.S. says President Trump will only agree to a deal with Iran if all his demands are met, pushing the brakes on an imminent deal to end the ongoing war. And later, rescue divers in Laos safely evacuate the first of five local villagers who had been trapped in a flooded cave for more than a week.
The first thing in the morning is Asia. Asia wakes up to a new day. Get up to speed with major events shaping lives in the region and other parts of the world.
Putting things in perspective with eye-opening reports and expert analysis as a new era of global politics breeds power struggles and shifting alliances.
We get to the heart of the matter and take stock of the issues you're invested in with on-the-ground reports and wall-to-wall coverage. Viewing it all from a regional lens because we put Asia first.
Little children stare at me because they've never seen young auntie using a cane to walk.
In office, some of them will call me the pharmacy dispenser because I have so many common medications.
My biggest wish is that she recovers to a certain extent, that the pain is manageable.
A new four-part series on living with chronic pain starts tonight on CNA.
Ready for the highest cashback on daily spend with UOB One credit card?
East Asia, a region steeped in history, now helping to write the future of our world. From the corridors of power to the region's most remote corners, we'll break down the news driving some of the world's largest economies and explain why it matters.
On East Asia Tonight, with me, Otelli Edwards.
Rescuers in Laos have safely pulled out the first of five local villagers who had been trapped in a cave for more than a week by floodwaters. The man, who has not yet been identified, was immediately sent for medical checks, and crews will resume extracting the other four this morning. They say conditions remain extremely risky. The successful extraction of the first villager is a boost for rescue efforts as crews race against time and unstable weather to drain floodwaters and bring survivors to safety. Divers have delivered water, soft food, and foil blankets to keep the men warm. Two other villagers remain missing. Rescuers discovered the survivors about 300 meters from the cave's entrance, wearing headlamps and sheltering in a narrow chamber cut off by floodwaters and debris. Confirmation that the five villagers had survived came about a week after they went missing. The cave is located in a rugged and remote area north of the capital, Vientiane. And Lao officials say the group had ventured into the cave last week in search of gold deposits. But flash floods and landslides caused by heavy rain sealed their exit. Another villager who went into the cave with the seven was able to escape before it all happened and alerted authorities about the trapped men. The White House says U.S. President Donald Trump will only accept a tentative agreement with Iran if it satisfies all of his red lines after he wrapped up a key meeting with national security officials. Earlier in a post on Truth Social, Mr. Trump laid out everything Iran must do for him to approve a deal to end the war. This includes Tehran agreeing to never having a nuclear weapon or bomb, reopening the Strait of Hormuz for, quote, unrestricted shipping traffic, and destroying any mines in the waterway. As part of a potential deal, the U.S. is expected to end its naval blockade. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says some sanctions on Iran may also be removed depending on how talks proceed. Tehran, however, has insisted there was still no final agreement on ending the war. Its foreign ministry spokesperson pushed back against growing speculation that Washington and Tehran are on the verge of formalizing a broader understanding over nuclear-related issues.
تفاهم نهایی نشده. نکات دیگری هم که گفته شده از جمله فرض فرمایید راجع به موضوع هسته‌ای، باز من تاکید می‌کنم ما در این مرحله متمرکز هستیم بر خاتمه جنگ، بنابراین در مورد جزئیات موضوع هسته‌ای صحبتی نداریم در این مرحله.
The United States says military officials from Israel and Lebanon have held productive talks in Washington. The Pentagon, which is hosting the talks, said the meeting will complement upcoming diplomatic discussions. And landmark security talks are being held amid the backdrop of Israeli troops pushing deeper into Lebanon. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his forces have advanced to positions north of Lebanon's Litani River. And this comes days after he announced that the IDF is expanding ground operations beyond a security zone it has occupied since April. Evacuation warnings have been issued, forcing hundreds of families in Lebanon to flee.
احتياط بنبدي بحالي منروح على منطقة أمن وبس مثلا يطلع طيران وهيك يعني أكلنا كتير غارات كنا هودي الغارات اللي صاروا هون كانوا كتير كتير قوية علينا بقينا لوجه الصبح لضربوا فأكيد بتتأثر من الأصوات وفي عندي أحفادي بخافوا فبحضنهم.
Hezbollah militants say they have also launched strikes targeting northern Israel. The UN says it's deeply alarmed by the intensification of hostilities. The agency warns that access and emergency response capacity has been severely constrained, adding that all civilians, including health workers and first responders, must be protected.
Our OCHA colleagues report that humanitarian access and emergency response capacity continue to face severe constraints. In Nabatieh, strikes reportedly impacted a key road in Marjayoun that took place yesterday. That road is critical to emergency medical evacuations, also for aid and humanitarian workers to move about, and for people's access to essential goods and services.
The United Nations is also voicing alarm over Israel's plans to expand control to more than 70% in the Gaza Strip, saying the whole territory should be for the Palestinian people. Under a ceasefire deal, Israel's military was to remain in control of 53% of Gaza.
Sifting through rubble from fresh Israeli strikes, Gazans feared further displacement after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's latest directive. The Israeli leader on Thursday ordered the military to take more of Gaza, expanding the area it occupies to 70% of the territory. The population is already penned in to a tiny strip of land along the coast. Israel effectively controls an estimated 64% of the tiny coastal strip. It has been bombarded to ruins by Israel's two-year military assault that followed the 2023 Hamas attack on southern Israel. Displaced Palestinian Nazreen Abu Sada said she believes Netanyahu wants to confine Gazans in one area and take the enclave for himself. Among the fear and terror, she said, death would be a better fate for her people. An October US brokered truce has failed to halt Israeli attacks or secure Hamas's disarmament. But under the agreement, Israeli troops were meant to withdraw to a yellow line, demarcating the extent of their control. Marked on military maps, that line put Israel in control of some 53% of Gaza, with Hamas ruling the rest. Reuters has reported that Israel has unilaterally moved the yellow line on the ground deeper into Hamas-controlled territory.
Allahu Akbar.
Health officials say Israeli strikes have killed more than 900 people since the truce. And Israel says four soldiers were killed by militants during the same period. Israel and Hamas remained deadlocked in talks on the ceasefire's next phase.
Heading out for a short break, but ahead on Asia Now, Europeans urged to stay indoors and take precautions as the continent swelters under a deadly and exceptionally early heat wave.
The world is moving forward rapidly. Technology is transforming lives. Behind every breakthrough, energy is always at the center of progress. Powered by collaboration, accelerated by energy and AI. Join us at the Energy Transition Conference 2026.
CNA's the strategic media partner for the Energy Transition Conference 2026.
Ready for the highest cashback on daily spend with UOB One credit card?
Little children stare at me because they've never seen a young auntie using a cane to walk.
In office, some of them will call me the pharmacy dispenser because I have so many common medications.
My biggest wish is that she recovers to a certain extent, that the pain is manageable.
A new four-part series on living with chronic pain starts tonight on CNA.
Millions across Europe continue to swelter under an exceptionally early heat wave. Spain is experiencing its first spell of extreme heat this year. Temperatures have climbed up to summer-like levels across much of the country, with weather alerts issued in several regions, like Barcelona. Locals and tourists flocked to beaches as the mercury rose above seasonal norms.
Yo lo llevo bastante bien, o sea, teniendo agua fresquita, viniendo bien hidratado a entrenar, descansando bien, sobre todo. Creo que hace mucho calor, pero se está bastante bien.
Drink a lot of water, get some sunscreen, and just seeking a lot of shade, and that's going to it.
But authorities are warning that attempts to cool off can turn deadly. In France, rescue services say at least 7 people have died in incidents linked to the heat wave in recent days. 5 of those deaths were drownings. Officials say many entered rivers, lakes, or other unsupervised waters where swimming was prohibited or unsafe.
On a vu ce week-end des noyades, qui étaient surtout des noyades évitables, des personnes qui se sont baignées dans des rivières qui n'étaient pas autorisées à la baignade, dans des endroits qui n'étaient pas surveillés. Et donc, avec des jeunes, notamment, on voit des adolescents qui se sont noyés.
Meanwhile, in Germany, hot conditions are lingering, with temperatures reaching 31 degrees Celsius in some areas. Forecasters, though, say cooler weather, along with showers and thunderstorms, is expected in the coming days. Weather forecasters in Singapore are expecting a hotter and more long-lasting dry season this year. And the country's meteorological service says the island could be hit with a double whammy of climate phenomena from June. The agency says there is an 8 in 10 chance of El Niño occurring this year. It has observed warning signs such as water that is warmer than normal building up beneath the ocean surface in the eastern tropical Pacific. El Niño is likely to develop in June to July and may become stronger towards September. For Singapore, this often means hotter temperatures and less rainfall. From July to August, a positive Indian Ocean dipole is predicted to develop. Cooler surface waters in the eastern Indian Ocean lead to fewer clouds forming and less rainfall over parts of Southeast Asia. With both climate conditions bringing hotter and drier weather, the risk of vegetation and peatland fires in the region increases. Winds may also carry the smoke towards Singapore, bringing the haze. And the Met Service says Singapore's driest year on record was 1997, and that was when they also saw El Niño and the Indian Ocean dipole develop at the same time. It warns the dry season may extend into October, while one scientist says conditions may last until February.
Less rainfall would give us the chance that the pollutants will stay in the air longer time, and also good for the long-term, the long-range transport. And without the rainfall, there's a less chance that the pollutant in the air can be removed by a rainfall. So this is from the climate perspective.
And we are headed for a break now on Asia Now, but join us here on CNA as we'll bring you live coverage from the IISS Shangri-La Dialogue. And U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth set to deliver his remarks in just a few minutes from now. We'll be watching out for comments reflecting Washington's strategy in Asia's security landscape. Stay with us here on CNA.
日部隊のことはですね、私が証言するのは最後の人ではないかと。兵器とかまた機械を作るとかいうことだと思っていたのが、ただ結局最近の培養、試験的に培養をさせられとったので、ベスト菌なんていうのはね、なおそろあれが感染したら必ず死んでしまう。ひどいことがあったもんだから、
Inside Unit 731 Saturday and Sunday on CNA。
Every answer starts with a question and a trail we follow. We uncover what's hidden so you get clarity.
Indonesia's data center industry is booming.
Data center is a part of our priority in attracting investment coming to Indonesia.
However, there's mounting pressure to go green.
The users right now demands to see this happening.
Another demand, finding the right talent. Don't miss Indonesia's data center dilemma. Wednesday on CNA.
Good morning, you're watching CNA, and we're bringing you live coverage from the IISS Shangri-La Dialogue this hour. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is set to speak at a session shortly. And earlier this week, the Pentagon said he will be focused on the Trump administration's, quote, common sense approach to safeguarding U.S. vital national interests in the Indo-Pacific. And this year's conference comes with the Middle East engulfed by conflict, which observers say could affect Asia's security landscape as Washington pays more attention to the war and shifts key defense equipment out of Asia. And Asia's pressing security issues include North Korea's missile launches, China's maritime expansion in the South China Sea, and tensions surrounding Taiwan. That was a key topic during U.S. President Donald Trump's meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping earlier this month in Beijing. Border conflicts between Thailand and Cambodia have also intensified over the past year, posing a fresh challenge to the region. That's why all eyes this morning are on U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, whose address will come at a moment when questions are growing about Washington's ability to manage crises simultaneously in the Middle East, Europe, and the Indo-Pacific. If you're joining us now, you're watching CNA's live coverage of the IISS Shangri-La Dialogue 2026, and we're waiting for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's speech, which will be watched closely, not for just what he says about China, but for what he says about America's long-term commitment to allies and partners in Asia. Of the Shangri-La Dialogue with regional partners, including Singapore and Vietnam, focusing on defense cooperation and military modernization. What delegates want today, though, is the more specific details, whether broad commitments are expected. And the real question is whether Hegseth will outline concrete initiatives of the capabilities that back up U.S. commitments. And beyond the headline issues, delegates here are also watching closely to see how the U.S. balances its security commitments across multiple regions. A key question hanging over this year's dialogue is whether ongoing conflicts in Europe and the Middle East could affect Washington's ability to sustain its focus on the Indo-Pacific. This, as U.S. officials insist, the region remains a top strategic priority. Now, as we're waiting for the address to happen, another area to watch out for is defense spending and burden sharing. Mr. Hegseth has repeatedly called on allies and partners to strengthen their own military capabilities, arguing that regional security requires greater contributions from across the alliance network. Now, we'll connect live very soon to hear what Mr. Hegseth has to say, and we'll also include some expert analysis on the scene to break down the details. Last night,
for the opening dinner and keynote address. And in the keynote address last night, His Excellency Tso Lam called on nations to advance a shared vision to proactively shape peace, stability, and development. And a theme that has come up a lot in my conversations in the run-up to the Shangri-La Dialogue has indeed been fragmentation and the general sense that security challenges have intensified, and including here, of course, in the Asia-Pacific, where yesterday the ISS released an Asia-Pacific regional security assessment that argued the region can no longer be classified as fully at peace. We are here to engage in defense diplomacy, to build a shared sense of purpose, and to see whether solutions to security challenges can be identified and pursued together. And I'm grateful to see so many defense ministers and military chiefs, alongside many senior leaders from government, the private sector, and the analytical community, all gathered here in this room to tackle this important task. In a minute, we will begin the first plenary session, focusing on the United States strategy in the Indo-Pacific. Before proceeding, let me just remind you all that speeches delivered during the plenary sessions at the Shangri-La Dialogue, as well as the Q&A phase, are on the record. If you wish to take the floor to ask a question or make a comment, you have a microphone at your seat to do so. You will need to insert your delegate badge on the right side of the microphone unit to activate the microphone. And there are two steps here. So you insert the badge, you press the button that turns your microphone on. Once your microphone is on, it will turn green, and that means you're in my queue here on my iPad, and it is not yet a hot mic. When I select you from the list I have here, your microphone will turn red, and when it does so, you can ask your question and offer your comment. I encourage you to keep those comments short and crisp so we can generate meaningful answers, but also get to a number of questions. So now, let us return to the heart of our discussion, and I'm delighted to turn to Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War of the United States, who, if I counted correctly, is now on his fourth official visit to the region since taking office. And, of course, he was also in the delegation when President Trump visited Beijing recently. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the Shangri-La Dialogue. It is a pleasure to have you here, and we are honored that you are addressing the 23rd ISS Shangri-La Dialogue. The floor and the podium is yours. Welcome.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much. Good morning. It's great to be back in Singapore and at the Shangri-La Dialogue to speak about the future of this vital Pacific region. It's not a future based on wishful thinking or utopian idealism, but a future that will be defined by our collective efforts to safeguard and secure our most vital national interests. Under the leadership of President Trump, who has over the past year shown repeatedly what it means to defend American national interests, from Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela to Midnight Hammer to cartel drug boats to epic fury, we have restored a proactive and realistic approach to our own national defense, reestablishing deterrence. Now, when I was in the United States Army as a young lieutenant, the motto of my first rifle platoon was, "Those who long for peace must prepare for war." It's a simple truth that makes as much sense tactically as it does strategically. But today I want to lay out what this return to realism means for the most consequential region in the world, the Pacific. And as the 2026 U.S. National Defense Strategy makes clear, we are charting a new course for our alliances and partnerships, one that is grounded in the realities of power and interests. It is a course that will leave America stronger, our allies and partners more capable, and the Pacific region more stable and secure. The foundation of this new approach is moving away from a model of dependency and toward one of true partnership, embracing a perspective that our partners in Asia have understood for decades. Now, perhaps because of distance, or perhaps because of the hard-learned lessons of history, the default Asian lens on America has been clearer and far more pragmatic than in other regions. Our partners in Asia have long understood that the bedrock of a durable partnership is not based on idealistic values, but on the concrete alignment of national interests. There is undeniable strength in this clarity, and it's what makes our Pacific allies and partners such reliable counterweights in the face of regional threats. When our interests align, we act together with focused resolve. When our interests diverge, we adjust pragmatically, without the drama or the moralizing. I think Western Europe might take note. This is a mindset we fully embrace. The era of the United States subsidizing the defense of wealthy nations is over. We need partners, not protectorates. We seek alliances built on shared responsibility, not dependency. This is the maturation of our alliances in a new era. It's a vision that puts our alliances on a sustainable footing, ensuring they are fit for the challenges of this century, not the last. The shift is not a matter of choice, it is a matter of strategic prudence. The National Defense Strategy makes clear that the old toothless, utopian, and globalist course of foreign policy was headed for a disaster. That all changes under President Trump. Our approach is one of flexible, practical realism that looks at the world with a clear-eyed perspective that is essential for serving vital interests. And nowhere is this clarity more important than in the Pacific. This region has profound implications for U.S. security and prosperity. It's the world's largest and most dynamic market area. It's why our National Defense Strategy directs the Department of War to set the military conditions required to achieve a lasting and favorable balance of power in the Pacific region. When we look across the region today, there is rightful alarm regarding China's historic military buildup. and the expansion of its military activities in the region and beyond. We share a clear-eyed assessment of that security environment and a mutual understanding that a Pacific dominated by any hegemon would unravel the regional balance of power and undermine the equilibrium we all seek to preserve. The Department of War is working with the utmost focus to prevent any such unraveling. We do not approach this challenge with needless confrontation, but with a posture of measured and deliberate strength. Our focus is strong, quiet, and clear. Strong, quiet, clear. Clear about our intentions, our priorities, and our ability to deliver on the administration's goals. This is a model our Asian partners vastly prefer and have long followed. Our allies across Asia do not seek constant escalation, rhetorical theatrics, or a region defined by public confrontation. What they want and what the United States delivers is strength that is disciplined, resolve that is steady, and leadership that is confident enough to speak and walk softly while carrying a big stick. What we seek and what the president has constantly articulated is a genuinely stable equilibrium that works for Americans as well as our ally, a favorable but durable balance of power in which no state, including China, can impose its hegemony and hold the security or prosperity of our nation and our allies in question. The United States seeks to preserve the conditions that have long underwritten peace and prosperity in this region. We are the power working to sustain equilibrium, not to disrupt it, plain and simple. We defend a status quo that has enabled extraordinary growth and opportunity across the region. Our interests in the Pacific are significant, but they are also scoped and reasonable, defined by a favorable balance of power in which sovereignty is respected, commerce flows freely, and nations retain the freedom to make their own choices. This is the balance America upholds and will not allow others to overturn. Under President Trump's leadership, relations between the United States and China are better than they've been in many years. President Trump and this administration seek a stable peace, fair trade, and respectful relations with China. It's not a coincidence that this has happened. Strong, quiet, but clear is the right recipe for stability. Just 2 weeks ago, President Trump and President Xi engaged in direct discussions in Beijing that reinforced this very foundation. I bore witness to their hours of candid conversations. It was truly historic. They agreed that the United States and China should build a constructive relationship of strategic stability based on fairness and reciprocity, reaffirming that while our nations will vigorously protect our respective interests, we can secure practical, mutually beneficial agreements where our interests align. Now, all of that said, my job at the United States Department of War is to provide the military strength to support President Trump's visionary and realistic diplomacy. It's our essential responsibility at the department to ensure that the president is always negotiating from a position of unquestionable strength in order to sustain peace here in the Pacific and around the globe. To ensure our military might preserve stability, we will pair it with a clarity of intent, which is why we are meeting more frequently with our Chinese counterparts. By maintaining open lines of military-to-military communication, we can coordinate, deconflict, and reduce the risk of miscalculation. This dialogue is not a sign of capitulation in either direction, but a practical guardrail, ensuring the relationship our leaders seek at the top is preserved at every level. And while a decent peace is our goal, make no mistake, America is a Pacific nation, and we insist that China respect our longstanding position in the region, and not just insist, but maintain the manifest military strength to underwrite it. Now, to get that job done, we are changing the playbook. The era of performative outrage is over. where Washington issues loud diplomatic protests that signal virtue but do not project capabilities. Going forward, we will be intentional about how and when we communicate. And we will lead first and foremost with actions. As I said, strong but quiet. Big stick, speak softly. We will prioritize lethal capabilities, strategic discipline, and business-like cooperation over empty rhetoric and peacocking. Any potential opponent will be forced to judge us by our hard power, collective readiness, and steadfast resolve. As the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy direct, our approach in the Pacific centers on deterrence by denial along the first island chain. Now, we are reestablishing the Monroe Doctrine, the Donroe Doctrine, as I like to call it, in the Western Hemisphere, aggressively defending our homeland and our hemisphere. We will protect our people. But if you look at our department's planning guidance and our budget, we're building a team capable of projecting power, a country capable of projecting power anywhere in the world, most especially here. We will build and sustain a strong denial defense in the Western Pacific that ensures aggression is infeasible, escalation unattractive, and war deemed irrational. Our military posture will be resilient, distributed, and optimized to deny quick, decisive gains through military force. This is the logic of strategy. And it's the essence of peace through strength and the foundation of a durable peace in the Pacific that benefits all of us. We all benefit from such a policy because our quiet but clear strength will lead to stability and peace. But this is not a burden America can or should carry alone. A favorable balance of power requires capable allies with real military strength, real industrial capacity, and real political resolve. For too long, the security of this region has rested disproportionately on American military power, while many of our allies and partners allowed their own defense capabilities to atrophy. That's a bad deal for the American taxpayer, and it's an unsustainable crutch for our allies and partners. Instead, we are all best off when, based on our comparative advantages, we all contribute to the shared goal of peace and stability. This is not a my way or the highway approach. We are ready to work with all of you, where you are, based on your own situation, your own geography, and your own cultural, political, and economic realities, to ensure that a Pacific free of any dominant hegemon is secured. And that's why a core line of effort in our national defense strategy is to increase burden sharing with U.S. allies and partners, and simultaneously empower them to contribute to our collective defense. This is no longer an afterthought. It's an essential ingredient of our strategy. President Trump has been crystal clear about this from day one in his first administration and now in his second. Alliances only work when they are true partnerships. It is a two-way street. You don't have a strong alliance unless everyone has skin in the game. No freeloading. History is not over. Alliances are not judged by the number of flags, but by the number of formations. We don't need more conferences, we need more combat power. I'm sorry to say this here. Less Shangri-La, more ships, more subs. For too long, polite pleas from our European allies to spend more on their own defense fell on deaf ears. They're finally playing catch up, and we let ourselves get distracted by empty globalist rhetoric about the rules-based international order. While European capitals threw open their borders and hollowed out their militaries. You can have all the rules you want, and rules are great. But if you can't back them up with hard power, the rules are not worth the paper they are written on. Europe and NATO have some big decisions to make, and more on that soon. These same principles apply in the Pacific, albeit of course, in different circumstances. In this region, I'm optimistic that our allies, driven by our shared national interests and the unprecedented threat environment, will step up and step up for real. In fact, we're already seeing progress. If you want to see what burden sharing looks like, consider the Republic of Korea. South Korea has invested consistently in its own defense, not because it does not have the luxury of treating war like an academic exercise. They live on the front lines, and so they build real combat power. President Lee's decision to increase defense spending to the new global standard of 3.5% and to assume greater responsibility for its conventional defense reflects simply a clear-eyed understanding of the threat environment. It won't be easy, but it's necessary for the security and prosperity of his country. This was a hard-nosed decision because they see the world as it actually is. We applaud the pragmatism and leadership demonstrated by Seoul. The region will be far more stable and more secure when other allies and partners follow that path. We see this same realist mindset from the Philippines. Manila is shifting its focus to external defense and enhancing interoperability with U.S. forces. And it's not just talk. Earlier this month, we concluded the largest ever Balikatan, which featured joint training and exercises involving the most advanced U.S. capabilities. The Philippines is also investing more to modernize its military and its Coast Guard, with President Marcos signing a budget this year that includes a 12% increase in defense spending. This spending increase will fund the Philippines' multi-year effort to develop a modern, technologically advanced, and interoperable force that can plug in and fight alongside American warfighters. We're seeing a similar and critical shift in Tokyo. Japan is taking concrete steps to accelerate its defense transformation. Together, we are enhancing our force posture and investing in the right capabilities. We're not at the finish line yet, and there's still some heavy lifting ahead, but the momentum is headed in the right direction. We have high expectations of our Japanese allies, and together we can and must each pull our weight to strengthen the U.S.-Japan alliance. Strong, quiet, clear. Australia is stepping up. Together, we are expanding the rotational presence of U.S. forces and collaborating to ensure our defense industrial base build and sustain weapons required for a high-end fight. We appreciate Australia's investment in real combat power and the commitment to integrate more deeply with the U.S. joint force. Across Southeast Asia, we're seeing our partners step up also. Our hosts, Singapore, consistently punch above its weight by investing heavily in its military and serving as a vital hub for U.S. logistics activities and rotational deployments, strengthening our shared regional posture. Indonesia, too, is making important strides as it modernizes its armed forces and expands the scale of military exercises with us and our partners, strengthening interoperability and reinforcing regional stability. I also want to recognize Malaysia's leadership in rapidly deploying ASEAN observer teams to monitor the Thai-Cambodia border. That is burden sharing in action. Nations in the region stepping forward to preserve peace, reduce tensions, and support diplomacy with credible capability. I commend Malaysia and ASEAN for their efforts in support of President Trump's historic peace deal. On the mainland, Thailand continues to deepen military cooperation with the United States to enhance interoperability and develop necessary readiness. Thailand, a longtime U.S. partner, investing even more. We're also seeing the same seriousness of purpose from Vietnam. Hanoi is diligently modernizing its maritime capabilities while expanding pragmatic defense cooperation with the United States. Vietnam is a great example of how nations with distinct histories and different political systems can work together in practical ways, advancing discrete efforts where our interests align to maintain a stable regional balance. And in South Asia, India is a critical anchor to hold the line.
A powerful India acting in its own self-interest advances our shared goal of maintaining a balance of power across the region. India is modernizing its military to carry its share of the security burden, particularly in the Indian Ocean. It's building out the heavy industrial and logistics capacity to sustain high-end military operations, including the ability to repair and maintain our shared platforms and support U.S. Navy vessels operating forward in the theater. We've also committed to pursuing co-production with India to advance capabilities like Javelin anti-tank guided munitions. Real, tangible steps to improve the collective readiness of our forces. This kind of industrial muscle isn't just a long-term goal, it's an immediate operational imperative. And the United States Department of War is leading the way. America is undergoing a historic national manufacturing mobilization of our defense industrial base. We will produce the best weaponry in the world at scale, at speed, and at a reasonable price. This is my personal commitment to all of you, and it is our president's demand. And it's why President Trump, after spending $1 trillion on defense last year, plans to make a generational investment of $1.5 trillion on defense this year to unleash America's arsenal of freedom and expand America's military dominance for decades to come, a generational investment. President Trump is setting the gold standard. We demand 3.5% from our allies and partners, and we are going well beyond that number. We expect every single ally and partner to match that kind of resolve. For those nations that rise to this challenge, that embrace responsibility as true partners, the benefits will be clear. As our strategy states, we will prioritize working with model allies, those nations who are most capable, clear-eyed, and ready to defend their national interests. For those nations, we are moving them to the front of the line. Expedited arms sales, deep industrial-based collaboration, expanded intelligence sharing, the list goes on, the benefits many. But for those who believe they can continue to free ride on the generosity of the American taxpayer, hear us now. Those days are over. Allies who refuse to step up and carry their own weight for our collective defense will face a clear shift in how we do business. President Trump believes in helping countries that help themselves. And the United States Department of War feels the exact same way. That is the nature of burden sharing. It's what we owe each other, and most importantly, what I owe the American people and my troops. The most precious asset we have. The world today is unforgiving. And that's why this bold path is a matter of strategic necessity. We have a responsibility to our people to shape the world that comes next. And under President Trump's leadership, that is exactly what the United States of America is doing. The U.S. War Department is advancing an America first, peace through strength, common sense agenda. We are reviving our warrior ethos inside our ranks. We are rebuilding our great military, and we are reestablishing the deterrence that was so dangerously allowed to erode under the Biden administration. Under President Trump, we have the most powerful and capable military in the history of the world. But our approach is not one of isolation. America first does not mean America alone. But it means realist engagement with a clear eye toward defending our most vital national interests. It's an approach that values actions over words and sees alliances as true partnerships measured by the sovereign strength and capabilities brought to bear by each member. Practical, interest-driven models of partnership is not a cynical compromise, but instead the most realistic and reliable foundation for enduring peace in the Pacific. Our approach asks Pacific nations to do what many are already eager to do, invest seriously in their own defense, contribute more to collective security, and work with the United States in pragmatic ways that advance our shared interests. If there was a thesis statement for my remarks this morning, it would be this. Join us in embracing this vision, in building a team of strong, self-reliant nations fully capable of defending their own sovereignty while contributing to our collective security, in preserving the favorable balance of power that benefits all of us. Strong, quiet, clear. I've said this before, but it bears repeating again and again. Those who long for peace must prepare for war. From my first platoon to the first island chain. Let that remain at the forefront of our minds because we all long for peace. That time is now. The challenges we face are real, but so is the opportunity before us. We must meet that moment. And may Almighty God bless all of our troops in harm's way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Secretary Hegseth, thank you so much for your remarks and the great clarity of your message. And if you allow me one comment, we are the Shangri-La wish ships, searching for wisdom, but with a very clear sense that one needs to Absolutely. Invest in combat power and capability, as you so eloquently underlined. We've got about 30 minutes for conversation now. And we'll collect a few questions. But I see, actually, that the Minister of Japan, Koizumi-san, would like to intervene. So I might turn to him first, actually, and get him to make his comment. Your microphone is live now, Minister.
Thank you very much, Pete, Secretary Hegseth. Thank you for your remarks and very powerful speech, which was strong, not quiet, unclear. I appreciate being in close communication with you. I safely feel the unwavering commitment by the U.S., but sometimes I feel some countries might underestimate the U.S. commitment. Can you give us the message to assure the region? And also, when tensions occur between allies and like-minded states, even tensions are slight, there will be someone attempting to drive a wedge between us. I feel the U.S. commitment is unwavering, which might be underestimated by some countries, but you are here with us today. That speaks the strong message. Japan has recently revised its policy on the transfer of defense equipment and technology. I have been advancing defense equipment cooperation with Australia, the Philippines, and New Zealand, and Indonesia too. We are making those efforts to establish resilient supply chain so that countries in the region can help each other in case of crisis. I believe this initiative is aligned with the arsenal of freedom. Is my understanding correct? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister Koizumi. Maybe, Mr. Secretary, if that's okay, if I can invite you to respond to the Minister straight away, and then we group a few questions
sure.
together. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Please. Well, Minister Koizumi, thank you for the question, for your friendship, for your engagement. I think our countries and our personal engagement is demonstrative of the kind of commitment the United States has to allies and partners. And we appreciate the extent to which you and your government have stepped up. And I think there's sort of two real ways when I look at how the world may view our commitment to this region. First is through our national defense strategy. And we very clearly listed four pillars. It was the homeland of the hemisphere, deterring China in the Indo-Pacific, burden sharing, and then supercharging our defense industrial base. Those were the four. And I think too many people were focused on the fact that number one is homeland and hemisphere. For us, that was a reorientation toward a forgotten aspect of our defense strategy. We had a wide open southwest border that allowed 20 million illegals to pour across our borders that the Department of War was focused on securing. We've got a cartel problem of foreign terrorist organizations where we can't just defend at the border, but we need to defend in depth. So we've created the America's Counter Cartel Coalition, working with allies and partners in Central and South America to holistically get at the counter cartel challenge. Key terrain like the Panama Canal is something we
lost focus on, were refocused on, and Venezuela has seen a complete change, which creates complications for our adversaries. So staying focused and bringing renewed energy to Southern Command, which had been kind of a sleepy backwater command and now is a warfighting command in our own home and hemisphere, was something we had to do institutionally. But if you look at our defense planning guidance or our national defense strategy, we are funding toward, exercising toward, and planning toward the most difficult problem set, which is power projection into this region and working with our allies and partners. So there's a refocus in what we do in our own neighborhood, but an understanding that a $1.5 trillion investment from, you know, cislunar to subsea is what's required in order to deter the next conflict. And then I think the second aspect is that people want to conflate that we have global obligations with turning of our backs to this region. And that's why I've made more trips here than anywhere else and have met and will continue to meet with individual countries and in collective settings like this to demonstrate we are quietly but very strongly working by, with, and through allies based on our mutual commitments to strengthen our capabilities out here. We still have global obligations to ensure that, say, Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. We're focused on that. We can do two things at one time. We're supercharging our defense industrial base so that we're building 2X, 3X, 4X the munitions very soon to ensure that all of our O plans are properly funded throughout the world. So I think because there's been a lot of talk previously in the U.S. government about pivots that were never real, there's an instinct to want to look at this and say that it is not. But I think it's the exact opposite. Underneath our entire approach is a substantive, serious approach to the Pacific, while also ensuring we maintain our obligations around the world. So thank you for your question.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll group a few questions together now. The list is extremely long already, so I'll pull out a few. First, in this round, please, from Korea, Dr. Chungmin Lee. Chungmin.
Thank you, Bastian. Mr. Secretary, thank you for your positive remarks on the ROK-US alliance. South Korea's defense spending this year increased 8.2%, and we are fully committed to every single matrix you mentioned on a self-reliant defense posture. In this regard, my question to you, sir, is twofold. Number one, President Trump said yes to President Lee's request for American support in building nuclear-powered submarines for the ROK Navy for larger deterrence missions. And number two, wartime OPCON transfer to the ROK within the next couple of years. Could you please enlighten the audience on these two aspects of the strong and stronger U.S. ROK alliance? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chungmin. We'll take one or two more in this round. Next, please, from China, Weibin Zhao. Your microphone is on.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm the Secretary. I'm Senior Colonel Zhao Weibing from China. You just mentioned in your speech that during President Trump's historic visit to China, the two countries have agreed upon a new definition of China-U.S. relations, which is constructive strategic stability. So what's the implication of this new definition for U.S.-China military-to-military relations in particular? As a head of the War Department, how would you implement the consensus reached by the two heads of states in real tangible steps rather than peacocking? Yes. So how would Pete bring peace in and war out, bring cooperation in and confrontation out? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll take from the United States, Douglas Greenlaw.
Secretary Hegseth, thank you for your principled leadership of the Department of War. Under your leadership, the Pentagon has placed a major emphasis on the key core principles like lethality, reconstruction of the defense industrial base, including accelerating innovation by leveraging private capital and commercial technology. What would you like to see from private capital to help scale these innovations, including internationally, so they can be useful not just to the U.S., but to the defense posture of the Indo-Pacific?
Thank you very much. I see there's we have a young leaders group here as well, and I want to get in one of the younger voices in the room as well. So if we can please get from Pakistan, Tanzila Khalil, your microphone is on. And then we'll return to the Secretary.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Recently, it was identified by the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, that Pakistan's potential ICBM capability as a future threat for the U.S. I wanted to seek your comment on how do you assess India's long-range missile capability, particularly in terms of the recent test of Agni-6 ICBM with a range of approximately 12,000 kilometers. Which could potentially place some parts of Europe and America within reach. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. So we've got a summary of the themes there as well. So, Mr. Secretary, can I invite you to weave your way through these various comments?
I can't weave as well as my boss can. not possible. First on Korea, I see General Brunson is here, our commander. Who does a phenomenal job there, ensuring that partnership is realized and deepened every single day. And I think it really does exemplify the kind of partnership, and that's why I led with the remarks about what South Korea's done. I was there when the president talked about nuclear power submarines. I think it's an important capability. I think we're looking for allies willing to expand subsea capabilities that produce real dilemmas. And I think that's, you know, what we recognize is that our undersea warfare capabilities is unmatched, substantially unmatched, and creates a lot of strategic dilemmas for potential adversaries wondering where we are and what our capabilities may be. Allies and partners seeking similar capabilities in their own defense and in regional stability makes a lot of sense to us. So I think when you're working with and talking to President Trump, someone who's willing to think outside the box and shake up sort of a stale view of what may or may not be possible, expand the Overton window. Asks like that are important, and I think you'll see an acceleration in our willingness to come alongside countries that want to run quickly. Now, there's challenges, and how we get past them will require collaboration, but we're very much committed to that. And then as far as wartime OPCON transfer, the general and I have, you know, spent a good chunk of time recently talking about that. We met recently in the Pentagon with your Minister of Defense, on that very topic, and frankly, it's a breath of fresh air for an ally to want to take more control more quickly, and that is an instinct we want to continue to incentivize, and I think we have to find the balance of where our military O plans and the responsibilities that U.S. uniform members have had for decades now is honored as we phase over to wartime OPCON transfer for the Republic of Korea, which we welcome the fact that they want that. And I think it provides even more optionality for both the Koreans and the United States there in the peninsula going forward, which is a very good thing. So I appreciate that question. The second question was from Colonel, the Chinese military. Thank you for that question. And I think I was there when the conversations were had about constructive strategic stability. I think that was a great framing from both leaders about what they want from that relationship. And I think it's hard to understate the importance of the, you know, books have been written about the importance of interpersonal diplomacy and how strong it can be. I think in this particular case, it's quite meaningful. I think there is a mutual respect, a recognition of capabilities and power and how that could be most usefully leveraged in the world today with both powers that I want to reassure this audience, I think it's real, I think it's substantive, and I think it's meaningful for the history of peace in the region and the world. And what he has communicated to me is that manifests in mil-to-mil cooperation, that in forums like this, we maximize the opportunities to confer. I wish my counterpart was here at this conference, but I look forward to other options when we can cross paths and communicate, talk about things where often actions at sea or actions in the air are perceived differently when there's no communication than when there's an opportunity at the more tactical or operational level to talk about what deconfliction looked like. And I think what you'll get from the United States is good faith engagement. Clear-eyed, but good faith engagement that we are, I understand commander's intent.
And President Trump has said we're going to establish this type of framework, and I think it's important for peace in the world. The third question was about defense innovation and private capital's role. The static model of how the United States of America procured weapons and acquired weapons was insufficient for the modern age. You effectively had five prime contractors who were appended, in some cases, in not all cases, but in too many cases, appendages of the Pentagon bureaucracy, and had been grown accustomed to meeting the, you know, cost overruns, the time overruns, and the congressional annual system that gave everyone excuses to perpetuate that. Didn't give us enough, fast enough, always seeking the 100% solution that arrived a decade later, as opposed to the 90% solution that we get in the hands of warfighters 2 years from now. And so I think one of the unsung heroes of our department is my Deputy Secretary of War, Steve Feinberg. He's our secret weapon. He came from the business, truly. If you don't know him, you should get to know him. He came from the business world and has taken that very same business mindset, I think for the first time ever inside the Pentagon, and has effectively said, and this is, there's a lot of micro aspects to this macro approach, but if you want to do business with the Department of War, we'll make a trade with you. We will give you long lead times on critical munitions that we're clearly going to be purchasing for 5 to 7 years, or platforms. We're going to move into platforms. We're going to move into ships. We're going to move into airframes. You name it. You know we're going to be buying these, and Congress has been willing to move into multi-year procurement for us, which is a statutory requirement eager committees have given us and we have to be responsible with. But in exchange for 5 to 7 years of orders, we're demanding that those companies invest in their own infrastructure. So these companies are paying for new factories, new lines, new production facilities to the tune of $50 billion of capitalization. $50 billion that's not coming from U.S. taxpayers. It's coming from companies who would otherwise, in a world of private incentives, made those investments, but it's become cozy and easy to get the taxpayers to pay for that and then pay for the munitions as well, and we've just done it the same way. So over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to see hundreds of production lines coming online for critical munitions so that if we need more Patriots or THAADs or SM-3s or Tomahawks, or our partners do, it's not add another shift to try to eke out another 100. It's build three more plants so that we can 3X, 4X, and 5X the amount of those munitions that we're creating, which gets skin in the game for those companies as well. And through doing that and opening up our bureaucracy, which we go to war with our bureaucracy every single day, our job is to make sure we don't have five prime contractors by the time I'm done, but we've got 10, 15, or 20 who are able to compete on an equal footing, and now you really are building an arsenal. And then if you add on top of that co-production with partners around the world who want to do the same, now you're building a global arsenal of freedom that we require. We take very seriously our responsibilities, the foundation for Western defense, but the more rich countries who have robust manufacturing capabilities get into the defense business, because of the reality of the moment, the more options we're all going to have. And so we welcome that and want to be a leader there. The final question was about India-Pakistan. And I mentioned India here, but I very easily could have mentioned Pakistan and the role that the field marshal and the prime minister are playing in peace negotiations. I think an unexpected development and a true friendship developing there, which I think is important. And you saw that in the ability of the president to come together on brokering a peace between India and Pakistan, two nuclear-capable countries. I think both sides there are going to see understandable threats coming from the other, maybe some of which we see differently, and countries are going to want to develop ICBM threats. But we're not pointing a finger, at least from our view right now, at either country and calling them a threat to us, and we're grateful for, in each of their lanes, the benefits they've given to peace around the world.
Excellent. Let us get one more round of comments and questions in. If I can ask for crisp, short questions so that we can get to answers. First one in this round from the United Kingdom, Tom Beckett.
Mr. Secretary, thank you very much. Applauding the defence procurement changes that you're making in the Pentagon, On the 22nd of May, the acting Secretary of the Navy said that the 14 billion FMS to Taiwan had been paused to preserve stocks for epic fury. Looking to the future, that's fine. In the here and now, how do you reconcile that with expedited arms sales for partners?
Thank you very much, Tom. We take another question from China, Dong Wang. Your microphone is on.
Thank you for your speech, Secretary Hegseth. Most recently, U.S. Forces Korea Commander General Xavier Brunson made a striking remark in a public interview, stating that South Korea is, quote-unquote, a dagger in the heart of Asia aimed at China. This comment stands in a stark contradiction to the spirit of a constructive China-U.S. relationship of strategic stability, which our two presidents agreed to build during President Trump's most recent visit to China, which you also just referred to in your speech. President Trump, in particular, has also repeatedly emphasized his desire to forge the best possible relationship with China. My question is simple. Does General Brunson's statement represent the official position of the Trump administration? And is characterization of South Korea's role as a dagger aimed at China authorized or endorsed by the Pentagon? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The general is in the room, so he has an opportunity to perhaps follow up with you in the coffee break. But let me get one or two more questions in for this round. And we'll next turn from India to Vipratap Vikram Singh. Vipratap.
Thank you, Bastian. Secretary Hegseth, how does the Department of War expect to establish equitable cybersecurity partnerships with allies who may lack the domestic intelligence and technical capabilities? Is there a risk that this may create an overdependence on the U.S. private sector, which might further perpetuate a protection-based model for cybersecurity in the region?
Thank you very much. And we take from New Zealand, Anna, if you feel. Anna.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I couldn't help but notice that New Zealand was missing from your list of countries there. They have recently outlined a plan to get from 1% to 2% of GDP, a long way from 3.5. Would you consider New Zealand to be a free rider? Thank you.
Certainly sharp and clear question. We will take from Australia, which I think was mentioned, and our young leader group, Lee Sun, over to you.
Thank you. By order of a risk to the strategic equilibrium, what issues or conflicts in the region is the US most concerned about?
Okay, thank you very much. And I'll just lob in one final one from Thailand. Panitan Watan Yagopon, your mic is on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for your remarks. Very strong, loud, and super clear. In Thailand, I think Thai public opinion about the U.S. is not good, given the fact that we are one of the oldest allies and benefited a lot more from trade, surprisingly. On the other hand, public opinion about China, it's not that bad, still very good, given the fact that the Chinese scammers are doing a lot of damages to Thai public and a lot of Chinese weapons on Thai Cambodian borders. Under your leadership, what can you do about it? And if I may, what can Thailand do more about it, in your opinion? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So again, a very rich set of themes to choose from. Perhaps, Mr. Secretary, I'll invite you to address that first point on Taiwan arms sales, and then we'll get through the other questions.
Yeah, I would, on the Taiwan arms sales, I would very much decouple the two, and we feel very good about our stockpiles, both how we use them and in epic fury in this historic moment, and I don't think enough credit has been given to President Trump for his willingness to take on this global threat and do so through Admiral Cooper and our CENTCOM commander in a devastatingly effective way. And you know, status as of right now is that any deal will be a good deal. And I had a chance to talk to President Trump this morning. He wanted me to reiterate how patient he is in ensuring that with America undertaking this kind of historic endeavor, any deal will be a good one, a great one. And he's patient in the pursuit of that because of how the implications of how that sorts out. And certainly our department, we were in a cabinet meeting just a couple of days ago, and the president said, hey, it will be a great deal. And if Iran doesn't want to make a great deal that ensures they don't get a nuclear weapon, they can deal with the guy on my left. That was the only time I've ever been accused of being on the left. And he was pointing at the War Department. And we're serious about that. Our ability to recommence if necessary is, we are more than capable. Our stockpiles are more than suited for that, both there and around the globe, because of how we balance exquisite and more plentiful munitions. So we're in a very good place. And I wouldn't, Hung Cao is fantastic, but I would not couple the two in any way at all. And I feel good about not only where we are, but where we are in future production rates as well. And I think there's been a lot of false reporting with the wrong motives about where we might be, the United States of America. And we're in a very, very strong position and feel only better about where we're going in the future. Any decision about future Taiwan arms sales, as the president said, will rest with him and is a nature of that relationship. And certainly having been there for those meetings in Beijing, there's no change in our status there. So just to clarify. Since the good general was name-checked, I don't know if he wants to say anything. I would always give the floor to an esteemed American general. General Brunson on South Korea, and then I'll take it from there if you want.
Can we turn on General Brunson's mic, please? Can you press the button on the? I think if we can get some support here, please. We need to insert the badge, probably. Okay. Yeah. There we go. General.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you so much for that. if you could please raise your hand, the gentleman who asked the question, that I might look at you directly. What I said was trying to describe the operating environment, because what's incredibly important in being strong and quiet is about being able to describe the environment wherein we're working. If you remember, the Prussian philosopher, military philosopher Clemens talked about Korea being a dagger pointed at Japan. The difference is we have to change our perspective, which is why the East-Up map is important. By changing our perspective, we take into account how others might see us in the region. We've got to be strong. We've got to have the right capabilities within the Republic of Korea, but we have to understand that those things still exist. And you have to combat those things every day. What I was trying to do in a place of learning was talk to War College students about how we have to change our perspective and think about where we are. Then I can advise not only my service secretary, but then my secretary, my boss in the Department of War, on what things we might do. The secretary also mentioned OPCON transfer. The position that we have within the peninsula, based on our great allies represented by Minister of Defense Ong Kyu-bak, who's right here in the front row, is important. But what's also important is that we have the right capabilities at the right place in the right time, but also take into account our perspective. I'm encouraged by the fact that my president and my secretary went to China. That is tremendous, and that we might have increased relationships where we might talk. And we have to remember that when we're talking to students, we want them to understand and appreciate other perspectives other than our own. So many times in over the course of my career and the secretary's career, we've thought blue and red. Mm-hmm. Well, now there's a green there where we might have in this green space the opportunity to talk and to have military thought. The only way there will be philosophers in the future wearing uniforms like myself will be that we enter into the field of ideas. And we challenge ideas. And I'm okay with the challenge of the ideas, but we have to remember that context will always be king. And we have to take remarks contextually. And I would encourage that you listen to the entire podcast as well as the speech that I gave to the War College students, which was pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that
response. That's why we gave him the mic.
Very good. We've got 2-3 minutes left to get to...
I'd like to give the remainder of my time to the general.
New Zealand defense spending. We've got that question on prioritizing regional challenges and conflicts. And then there was a question from Thailand as well.
There was a question on cybersecurity as well. I think what you've seen from our operations is how central we've made that capability, how important it is, how decisive it can be. And now that we're moving into the brave new world of AI and what it enables, the United States has incredible private sector advantages there that we intend to responsibly harness, which would require understanding how they work and how they can be utilized offensively or defensively, but responsibly, and working with partners on cyber. And those cyber relationships is going to be a huge part of how we enable partners, whether it's AI or not. New Zealand, I appreciate the question. If I'm being honest, 2% is not enough, and so 2% is freeloading. But I don't have anything against New Zealand. I want partners to step up. I didn't intentionally leave it off my list. I look forward to working with the new defense minister there and enhancing those capabilities. I think that relationship has been a very fruitful one for a very long time. But I think, as my friends Richard Marles and John Healy know, I'm probably the most blunt with our closest friends about what our capabilities are and where they need to be to ensure that we're locking arms and shields, considering the threats of the world. And we can't just say, oh, we've been friends for a long time, so let's work together. It's, we've been friends for a long time, so you better have the same capabilities we do, because if we don't, our alliance is meaningless. And that's the kind of realism President Trump has asked me to inject into all relationships. I can't remember the last question.
There was a question on Thailand.
I had a great meeting with one of our oldest allies, almost 200 years. And I think played a very constructive role and is continuing to try to play a constructive role in how that conflict gets resolved. Had a great meeting yesterday with the Minister of Defense, and I think we found some public ways and some private ways that we can deepen our partnership meaningfully. So certainly very committed to that relationship.
Fantastic. Secretary Hegseth, thank you so much for being at the Shangri-La Dialogue.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.
Thank you.
And we're coming back from U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's address at the Shangri-La Dialogue. And the central theme, as you heard, was realism. Hegseth argued that security partnerships should be based on protecting respective national interests, not ideals, with countries taking a clear-eyed view of the threats they face. And the Indo-Pacific, as he says, remains at the heart of U.S. strategy. And Hegseth described the Pacific as the world's most consequential region, saying maintaining a favorable balance of power here remains a core American objective. China was also in focus, as Hegseth warned about Beijing's military buildup and growing regional activity, also pointing to recent engagement between Presidents Donald Trump and leader Xi Jinping, saying relations are in a better place than they have been in years. But he drew a clear distinction between stability and dominance. While Washington wants a stable relationship with Beijing, Hegseth said the U.S. will continue working with allies and partners to ensure no single power dominates the Indo-Pacific. And a significant part of the speech was also directed at U.S. allies for carrying their own weight in geopolitically troublesome times. Hegseth argued that the days of countries relying heavily on American production while underinvesting in their own defense are over. He pointed to South Korea and the Philippines as examples of partners increasing defense spending and strengthening military capabilities.
Alliances only work when they are true partnerships. It is a two-way street. You don't have a strong alliance unless everyone has skin in the game. No freeloading. History is not over. Alliances are not judged by the number of flags, but by the number of formations. We don't need more conferences. We need more combat power. I'm sorry to say this here. Less Shangri-La, more ships, more subs.
So the message was clear. America first does not mean America alone. The U.S. remains committed to the region, but expects allies to carry more of the burden. Taken together, the speech was about deterrence, burden sharing, and strategic clarity. As you just heard, Hegseth repeatedly stressed military readiness and capability over rhetoric, and at one point even mentioning the region needs less Shangri-La dialogue and more submarines and ships. And perhaps the clearest summary came in three words that he returned throughout the speech, which was to remain strong, quiet, and clear. And Arnold Gay is at the Shangri-La dialogue. Let's go live to him now. Arnold, Pete Hegseth laying out U.S. policy for the Indo-Pacific, reiterating America's commitment to the region, but also calling on U.S. allies and partners to step up, share burden, and increase defense spending to at least 3.5% of GDP. Many things mentioned throughout the session. So help us break it down. What did you make of that address?
Okay, I have a few things, a few thoughts, but, you know, what I think doesn't really matter because I have an expert, you know, who's been listening to the speech, breaking it down as it was being spoken. His name is Dr. Jonathan Cavalli. He's a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and he's right here next to me, Dr. Cavalli. Thank you so much for, you know, coming on to talk about this. So the first thing that struck me as I was listening and as he ended the speech, that there was not a single mention of Taiwan, which many were saying is the elephant in the room. So I'm wondering what you make of this and how should we be interpreting this?
That was definitely an intentional omission, I would say. I would frame in the context of two important parts of the speech. First is clearly Hegseth was signaling to both allies and China that this would be a pragmatic relationship built on strength. And that his job as Secretary of War is to make sure that the United States has the ability to use its military for deterrence, and it's up to the president to decide where it's going to be employed.
Okay.
I do want to point out that actually Secretary Hegseth used the phrase first island chain multiple times.
Deterrence by denial.
That's right.
Yep.
So I think it actually was a way of talking about Taiwan as a military asset. Mm-hmm. In the context of larger strategic stability in the region.
Okay.
And I don't think that was a coincidence or an
right.
accident.
So he said, without actually mentioning Taiwan.
I think that's right. But also, you know, the consistent message was that this is a pragmatic approach to a region that wants a pragmatic United States.
Okay.
It's not about the regime type or the form of government inside that country. It is more what does it mean for the overall strategic balance and maintaining stability in the region, and thus making Taiwan a part of the first island chain puts it in the context the United States is trying to communicate to basically China
right.
and its allies.
I hear you. Okay, I want to pick up on the message or the tone, which we've talked about a lot, you know, ahead of this his speech. The tone was very different last year compared to the one he just gave. I wonder if you think this idea of building a constructive relationship is something that's genuine, first of all, and it's going to be sustainable? Or is it something that's happening because Trump and Xi just had a summit?
I think it's hard to say, obviously. I mean, when you emphasize the personal relationship between two leaders, a lot of variation can happen. I think there's a couple questions about that in the Q&A. But I think in general, it was reiterating, he used the term businesslike,
yep.
a great deal, pragmatic stability. We have to understand that every American administration for the longest time has been talking about military-to-military contact. That is central to crisis stability. I think it's only a good thing that this is the only, frankly, deliverable that came out of that summit.
And you think this effort, I mean, he specifically mentioned military-to-military, you know, communication and contact, and we do not have the Chinese defense minister here for him to work on that, I guess you could put it that way. So I'm wondering, though, what you make, first of all, of the absence of Dong Jun, for one, and do you see this as a possible way forward? I mean, we were talking a lot about guardrails last year, you know, someone doing something and there's no phone call to pick to talk to someone on the other side. Your take on it all?
So that's a great question. I think in general, obviously, it would be great if we had senior Chinese leadership here.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, given the reality and the structure of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, it really is kind of at the summit that really matters, and then military to military at sort of the tactical operational level. At this stage, it's much more important that operational commanders have some form of communicating if there is a crisis. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the military-to-military tie that I think they're focused on.
And I also want to ask you a little bit about what he said in terms of making sure that, I mean, last year he was here and you were here as well. He talked about, he basically had a long list of hardware, talking about a whole range of weapons and weapon mm-hmm. systems that, you know, the U.S. was planning to deploy or, mm-hmm. or produce. Is that something that's still been retained?
I think what was interesting to me was not the long list of hardware. It was the long list of allies that he mentioned.
Okay.
He pointed out very systematically, basically every major player in the region and had positive things to say about their contribution to collective deterrence.
Okay.
That was not a coincidence. I think that is, frankly, if not a change in attitude, it's definitely a difference in tone.
Okay.
Where the idea is it is in the collective interest of every country in the region to create sort of a self-sufficient ability to generate their own
security. So that's interesting. I think this part of the world, a lot of people, defense ministers and so forth, were looking at what he would say. Mm-hmm. And he was critical, I would say more critical anyway, last year. So do you think this is going to be received, you know, warmly or well? I'm not sure what word I should be using, by officials here who may want to work on this, I suppose.
Well, I can't read the minds of a.
But it's certainly different. It's certainly different from last year.
It's certainly different from last year. And I will say he led off, which I thought was very interesting, was he put the Indo-Pacific in a historical context of leadership here.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of dangled some challenging things about NATO and Europe, we have to say. More on that later.
Yep.
But he made that in contrast to leadership and countries in the region being pragmatic, focused on commerce, focused on stability, avoiding war, and the idea that you are going to have this business-like relationship where we can all actually get along through kind of mutual deterrence, collective security, but in a profoundly kind of self-interested way, the realist way. He said realist about 50 times, right?
Yeah, right. And I wonder what you think of China's reaction. I mean, this is on multiple fronts, but since we're just talking about burden sharing, let's start with that. I mean, what's Beijing? How's Beijing, you think, going to look at this, and what do you think is telling each other in terms of the leadership, in terms of the generals down the chain of command?
I think a couple things. First of all, this is both for China and the allies in the region, is that Secretary Hegseth reiterated that the Pacific is still the center of gravity to the United States outside the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And he had to come to Singapore to say that, given all that's going on in the world. And I think that's very important. I think China and the allies are going to have to remember that. Again, I think it's important in Sino-American relations that it is based on security rather than economic containment or nationalism or stepping into the Taiwan dispute. And so I think the fact that Secretary Hegseth emphasized the first island chain, which is an inherently security-oriented way of thinking about the region, I think that will be, frankly, probably reassuring to China that there's not this sense of economic containment. It's certainly not what the Department of Defense is working
on. Okay. The Secretary of Defense, War, talked about this new partnership with this part of the world. Is that really, I mean, he talked about having skin in the game. Is that any different from how he put it? I mean, the phrasing is slightly different, I suppose, but it seemed to me that this was something he started talking about last year. This is merely an extension?
I think that's right. I think the logic is the same. I think probably the way he talked about the Republic of Korea is probably the most significant, in which he talked about the transfer of operational control, as well as talking about South Korea, first and foremost, spending a significant amount of money on its own defense, working with the United States, becoming self-sufficient militarily. I think basically that is the relationship that this administration has always wanted with its allies. Frankly, it's not that different from what other administrations wanted with the allies. Maybe they went about it differently.
Okay.
But I think the fact that these regional players are spending more money on defense, understanding there's this kind of co-production relationship that is sort of the United States military's love language these days.
Okay.
I think that's new and very clear.
So this idea of moving up the queue, you know, if you, I mean, it's easy enough to understand, but I'm wondering of the implications, you know, for defense officials and for leaders, you know, can they afford, first of all, to hit that target, which apparently lies at 3.5 and above. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, that's one. But the other question I have is, so what happens to countries who cannot afford it or perhaps don't see defense burden sharing in the same light as South Korea or Japan might?
So again, I actually was rather impressed with how Secretary Hegseth singled out Malaysia's contribution as a good partner. Now, we would not think that Malaysia is a massive defense power, not spending that much on its military, but playing a role in regional politics that allowed the United States to specialize in something else. The thing he talked about last year and this year is the idea of comparative advantage. Every country has the ability to contribute to collective security based on their capabilities and their economies and their self-interest. Mm-hmm. And I think he has different expectations of South Korea and Japan than he has of Malaysia, and that's great.
Okay. It was also very interesting, you know, the way he phrased it, because last year, the way he positioned it was, you know, be careful about being overly dependent on China because there are economic and other implications of doing so. This year, he wasn't as direct in terms of, in fact, he was saying, we'll work with you wherever you are, whatever your cultural context, whatever your economic context, and we will take it from there. Again, you know, that seems to be something different, but is the underlying message still, you know, we want you to be an ally and we don't want you to be so closely aligned with Beijing?
I think it was deliberate that they didn't discuss it. I think when you think about the language, it was mostly language of security, language of deterrence, language of co-production and supercharging the American defense industrial base. When he does talk about the politics of the region, he emphasizes the free flow of commerce, right? He talks about prosperity, right? I don't think that has a determinative aspect of who you get that prosperity from. It seems like the Pentagon is pretty agnostic about where you make your money. They want to know where you get your security from.
Okay. And finally, before we let you go, Dr. Cavalli, no mention of the war in the Middle East. I'm wondering whether that's deliberate or he felt it didn't have a place here in this particular forum, or is there some other reason?
I think it was not accidental. Yeah. I do think the lack of mention of the Middle East and the occasional mention of NATO-Europe, not necessarily in a very flattering way, I think were both deliberate. Again, the implications of that war to underpin what the Secretary is saying remains to be seen, given the amount of munitions and operational ability we've expended, the United States has expended in the region. But having said that, what is very clear is that he prioritized between the three regions as well as the Western Hemisphere, and he came to Singapore to emphasize that this region is the priority for the department.
I guess he would be expected to.
I would hope so.
Okay, Dr. Cavalli, we have to leave it there. Appreciate you talking to us. Really, really some insights that I've learned as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's Dr. Jonathan Cavalli, Senior Fellow at the IISS. Back to you in the studio for now.
Thanks, Arnold, for that coverage. And we do have more on the Shangri-La Dialogue 2026 coming up over the coming hours. So stay with us here on CNA. The White House says U.S. President Donald Trump will only accept a tentative agreement with Iran if it satisfies all of its red lines after he wrapped up a key meeting with national security officials. Earlier in a post on Truth Social, Mr. Trump laid out everything Iran must do for him to approve a deal to end the war. This includes Tehran agreeing to never having a nuclear weapon or bomb.